Everyone, welcome back to the Reformed Fringe. We are two Reformed Baptist pastors, and we're trying to bridge this strange gap between the fringy world of the supernatural that exists not only in the Bible, but, you know, all in this strange world that we live in, and more kind of solid, foundational, doctrinal stuff that you get in the world of Reformed theology. And not a lot of guys out there doing that and trying to do it. That's what we really want to do. God has put us in this place to have some kind of an impact with that, and we're very thankful for it. I'm Doug Van Dorn, one of your hosts. I'm the pastor at the Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado in Boulder, and with me is John Moffitt. He is the pastor of Grace Reformed Church out there in Spring Hill, Tennessee, and John, I guess we could tell people about the Reformed Fringe like we have been doing. It's always good to do that. You know, we rebranded this podcast just a couple of episodes ago, kind of aligning it with what we think fits a little bit better, the idea of what we're trying to accomplish. And calling it the Reformed Fringe also has the advantage of matching up with this platform that we've created, where folks can come and talk about Reformed theology and fringy weird stuff on a place that they're not going to get harassed by other people because it's policed. And which is great, folks that are in there.
We've had
amazing discussions that we've been having. You know, so we would encourage you to, if that's something that you're interested in, if you've been listening to this podcast and you're like, man, I feel like I'm the only person out there who is like this, and you guys are a voice in the wilderness. Well, we're not the only people. And so we would love to get you into the fringe at the Reform, at just reformedfringe.com. And, you know, there's over 115 people that are in there now. It's, you know, still continues to grow every week, and it's just a great place to be. So come on over to the Reform Fringe.
For as small as that group is, it's very active.
It is very active.
It's a very active group. And
people good. That are in there are excited about these topics, and rightly so.
Dude, the amount of stuff I've learned from people in there has been some cool stuff in there. So, yeah, I'm excited to come join it. And, kind of our tagline, for those who don't know, is Doug and I are trying to put the fringe back in the Reform. And
because we actually think that there was some fringe in the Reformed at one point in time.
Yeah, kind of, you know. What's interesting about
I read our hymnals, and I got like, that was pretty fringy. That was a pretty fringy song.
That's right. And the people say, well, what's your definition of fringe? It's like, well, the things that people want to avoid because they're strange. And it's like, well, liberalism and rationalism decided to make everything logical. And it's like, you can't make the gospel logical. There's nothing logical about that. Another dimension? How do you make another dimension where actual beings such as angels and seraphims and cherubims and flaming swords and potentially dragons, throw that one in there. How do you make that logical? But yet it's a part of our faith. You know, I was preaching about this on Sunday, so lead it in a little bit to next week. But Paul says faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Christ. And he's contrasting that with what you can see with your eyes. And that's unfortunately where even Reformed faith has gone. Like, we are selective in our understanding of what is acceptable supernatural and what is unacceptable. So a little bit of what today's podcast is about. This is going to be, you'll notice often that Doug and I are going to talk about things that we're preaching on. Oh, Doug, we have to do the little advertisement. We got to do the one on your sermon from Sunday about the council in Paul. It'd be great.
It was pretty wild, man. We had quite the conversation last week as I was preparing for it. Acts 23 and how it's actually a subversion of the Enoch story of the Watchers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't People give it all like,
away.
What?
Don't give it away.
Yeah.
Come back in 2 weeks. We'll probably do that one. All right. Surprised we didn't pick that one for today. So I preached on Easter Sunday, and I was getting ready for it. I've done a 4-part series on Colossians 3, where Paul says that he didn't deliver us from the domain of darkness, but the rulers of this age were put to open shame and they were conquered. And why is that so important to Paul, where he talks about the forgiveness of our sins. So I'll just go up here and read this verse. He says, and you were, this is Colossians 2, not 3, Colossians 2, 13. And you were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh. God made alive together with him, having forgiven on us all our trespasses by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. By the way, I love how he set it aside as if it's no longer valuable. Because it's like, yeah, it's up there bloodied and whole. There's a big hole in it. Nobody can read it anymore. He's set aside up there. It's what a beautiful picture, right? But he's not done. This is what we always do. We always just think about us. Oh, my sins are forgiven. My earthly physical sins that I committed, Doug, those are forgiven. And Paul's like, yeah, but that's not all that's going on here. Way, way more that's going on. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. And so my brain started going, well, what did that look like? How did he disarm them? First of all, he removed the weapon of accusation out of their hand. That was what was nailed to the cross. But then how did he triumph over them? And how did he put them to shame? And so as I was processing this, one of the ideas that I was thinking about as a pastor, you know, where I was trying to think about illustrations, and the Trojan horse just came to my mind of like this. He totally just Trojan horsed them because they thought when he was being murdered on the cross that this was the end of it. And what they did not realize, and what Paul is saying, is the cross becomes the very thing that disarmed them. And they totally, and I love this. This is Corinthians. Paul says, if they would have known that they would have been defeated and disarmed by the cross, they would have never killed him. So today what we want to talk about is the implications and the idea of how the cross of Christ actually becomes the Trojan horse of hell, where all of a sudden Jesus dies. I love this. And the next moment, just in my mind, in the next moment, he's standing in front of the gates of hell, you know, whatever that looks like. I don't know. Hades, the underworld. And there's a knock on the door. Hey, guys, I'm here to get my keys. So this will be fun. We did a podcast back, last year sometime, about the descent of Christ. And we're going to kind of pick that up here. So before I do, I'm going to set this up, Doug, just about how it is that we got to the cross and how Satan, from the narrative, and then we'll kind of dialogue back and forth. What? I didn't even ask you this, but you would hold that most likely Ezekiel and Isaiah are speaking of the fall of Satan.
You're talking about Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I hold a kind of a dual view, an earthly heavenly mirror thing, because sure, both prophecies are about a king, a human king. So Isaiah, king of Babylon, Ezekiel, the king of Tyre, but in the divine council worldview, those kings are under the authority of heavenly beings. And so I think that's what's happening is that the prophets are using kind of well-known myths of what happened to the heavenly being and using that as a metaphor of what's going to happen to the earthly king.
Hmm.
And by myth, as we've talked about before, I don't mean fake. I mean, right, it's just simply a story of what had happened in the supernatural realm to most likely what we would call Satan, Lucifer, or whatever.
Right. So when you read the language that was said about the king of Tyre, also we think attributing to the fall of the evil one, he wanted to be the most high. He wanted to sit and have power. It literally says, "O day star, son of dawn, how you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars. I will set my throne on high." So he's wanting power, he's wanting prestige, and he ended up being destroyed for it. What's interesting is you then see this reversal. And sometimes we just, the part of the narrative that I think is fun is that we don't pay attention. Yes, the Romans are involved, and yes, the Jews are involved, but Paul tends to not only just say they were involved, but he attributes really, you know, when Jesus says, "Forgive them, Father, they don't know what they're doing," it's almost like this, a tip of the hat saying there's some other power happening here. There's something else going on. And this is where you have Paul giving the credit to Satan and his followers. So this is 1 Corinthians 2:8. None of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, that Jesus Christ was the mystery revealed, that he was going to be the one who set the captives free and disarmed Satan, if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Because they would have known what they were doing. So what's interesting is you have this last moment of temptation in the wilderness where Satan offers Jesus the nations of the world. And he says, if you want them, this is how you can get them. Worship me. Which is, again, a ploy right back to what is the same. He's still going after the same thing. He wants power and he wants to be worshiped. And Jesus says no. And so what you can see at this moment in the narrative is where things turn. And this is where Christ begins to go to the cross. You know, he looks to Judas and he says, go do what you must do. What happens? Satan enters into Judas and causes him to turn against Jesus. And the next thing we know, there is this crucifixion that happens. And what's interesting about the description of the crucifixion, it's really a retelling of, one, you have the arrogant being who wanted to take his place above God, and he was punished. Now you have the innocent one, who then receives the same punishment. So this is Philippians 2:8. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the death of cross, even the death of a cross. So if you even go back to Isaiah 53, it says he was despised and rejected. Well, what happened to Satan? He was despised and rejected by the heavenly host because of what he did. And so they what did they do? They sent him down. They defamed him. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed by our iniquities. So you see this all of a sudden, Satan ends up bringing this same kind of punishment upon Jesus because it's this irony, right? He was unwilling to worship Satan, so he's going to punish him, just like Satan was punished because he tried to take over the worship of heaven. And in his anger, he's blinded by what's happening. He's blinded by this entire scenario. And the way that we're, right before Jesus goes to the cross, this is John 12:31, Jesus says, now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. Well, John 12, that's right before the cross. And so you have to imagine the disciples, what they're thinking at this moment, right? Jesus just said that he's about to like take out the ruler and then he dies. What's with that? Because they didn't get it either. I mean, the whole thing is subliminal. So what's fascinating is that when you have this whole story, Satan's angry, he manipulates through the Jews and the Romans, they murder Jesus, and it's a total shame. Like he is shamed in every level. And they're thinking at that moment when Jesus finally dies, victory. The head crusher, the king who was supposed to crush my head, is now gone. Victory. And that's the Trojan horse moment, because, you know, if you know anything about the Trojan horse, it was after 10 years of war, they finally, like, they look out one morning and the battlefield is empty. And the only thing that's there is like this trophy of like, you win, we're out, you can have this horse. And so they go to bed that night. They bring the horse in, they party, they go to bed that night. And the next morning they wake up and the whole city is taken over.
Yeah.
This is exactly the description. This is why the descent into hell is so important, because death is over. We killed the guy. And then the next thing you know, you've got Paul and Peter telling you what's happening during Christ's death. What's going on with his presence? So that's kind of the setup, Doug. I'll kind of throw it back over to you before we keep going.
You know, as you were talking about the cross, like that being a retelling of the story of Satan, that's so interesting. I don't know if I've thought about it exactly that way before, but it's really the classic idea of subversion.
Yep.
Subversion is this idea of taking a story that everybody knows, and then you kind of retell that story in a way that it alters the meaning of the original and flips it on its head oftentimes. So it becomes ironic. I mean, you can do all kinds of things with it, but that's the idea that it's the same story, but it's done in exactly the opposite way for the exact opposite effects. This happens all the time in storytelling, and it happens all the time in the Bible. You know, I don't know that if you think this would be helpful or not, but We've recently been having some discussions on the atonement, you and I have.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And
yeah, I think it'd be helpful.
You know, I think it can add a little bit of light to what we're talking about here, just from a theological perspective, because Reformed folks and most evangelicals love to talk about the atonement as a substitutionary atonement. So it's really dealing with the penalty of sin. It's dealing with Christ being the substitute for my sin. He dies in my place, thereby taking the wrath of God upon himself, so that through faith, I might not have to have the wrath of God be placed upon me. His death as a sacrifice atones for my sin. It takes care of it. It brings forgiveness for that debt that I owed, all those kinds of things that are associated with that view of the atonement. It's a view of the atonement that was really started to be developed by Anselm, I think, in like the 12th, 1300s, something like that. And it became kind of the main focal point through which the reformers viewed the atonement. But a lot of people, and I don't understand this for the life of me. I mean, I get a knee-jerk reaction against some parts of some of the views of the atonement, but it's like people have created this either or that mm-hmm. you can only, Jesus' death only did one thing on the cross. That's it. So it's a substitutionary atonement. That's all it did. and you know, it's like they knee-jerk against something like a moral influence theory of the atonement, which is very Pelagian in its essence. Jesus mm-hmm. didn't die as a substitute for my sin. It's purely there as a way for me to have an example of how I should live my life. Jesus died as an example for me. But you know what? In as far as the moral theory goes, Peter says that Christ's death is actually an example for us. It's not that's right. that's the wrong thing. Yeah. It's that it's not the only thing.
Yeah. We'll have this mind in you, which is also in Christ Jesus. He humbled himself and went to the cross. That's Philippians.
Exactly. So there's all these different views of the atonement that I view them like looking at a diamond that's been cut and has different facets to it. It's sure. not that they're mutually exclusive unless somebody says, no, Jesus only died as a moral example.
Right.
That's wrong. But exactly. to say that he died as an example, that's not wrong. So mm-hmm. long as you understand that he also died as a substitutionary atonement. So long as you also understand another aspect of the atonement, which is the earliest view of the atonement that we have in the church that really dominated the church for 1,000 years, which is the ransom view. And
yeah.
And before I let you start talking about what that is and how it relates to what we're talking about.
Sure.
I don't know why it has to be Jesus either died as a substitutionary atonement or he died in some sense as a ransom, because those two things are dealing with very different ideas.
Yep.
And even entities in terms of what it is that Christ's doing. And when you can add to this idea of the atonement, in fact, the best place that I've seen this discussed is in Lewis and Demarest's integrative theology textbook, mm-hmm. where they go through all these views and they're like, well, this actually has some good things to it. And so does this one. And so does this one. And adding them all together, you get this incredible tapestry of what Christ did. So mm-hmm. how does the ransom theory of the atonement really help us understand what we want to talk about in this
sure.
podcast?
And I have some thoughts on that too. I've been thinking about it. After we talked, I was talking to a couple of guys in my church, and it's kind of like the substitutionary atonement almost becomes like the tree, the trunk of like what's happening on the atonement. But all these other aspects is what fills out the tree and makes it as beautiful as it is. Like you can, the moral example, you can't be saved by that, and you can leave it off and you still get a pretty good clear of the gospel. But you can't remove substitutionary atonement and get that same conclusion.
That's a great way of putting it. I like that.
Yeah. So it's like you have to have, so we agree, you have to have substitutionary atonement. But let's not say, let's just not leave the tree bare. You know, let's let it fill out. You know, there's a lot going on here. So this is where, when you hold to, I would say, a governmental theory, or if you're going to hold to the moral example, and we would say ransom, in my opinion, helps explain the supernatural nature of what's going on in the story. I think this is why it was lost and argued against, because we didn't understand how, when Paul was saying things like he transferred us out of the domain of darkness into the kingdom of his beloved son. Well, how did he do that? He did that through redeeming us or paying a ransom. So the ransom theory, you know, it basically, there's a debt that is owed. There's something that's holding you captive, or there's something that's keeping you from freedom or keeping you from being able to do something. And the way in which it described, you know, Paul says that the whole world lies under the power of the evil one. That's 1 John. Ephesians 2 says that we walk according to the prince of the power of the air, that we are part of this prince. Like he owns us and he guides our steps. We are part of that domain. And the way in which, when you read the text, he uses legal language to keep us in our bondage, which is why I think the Chronicles of Narnia story is so powerful, because she has this conversation with Aslan, saying that it was the law of the stone tables, that basically it's the law of the land and you have to uphold the law of the land. And the law of the land says that he belongs to me. And so there's this language where the law is condemning us, and Satan is a masterful lawyer who uses the law. He is this prosecutor who knows how to condemn us. Because how many times in scripture do we have him constantly accusing us, right? Revelation 12 is a great example of this. So he's using the law, and the law in some way is what's holding us captive. Now, the ransom being paid, this is where the conversation that you and I are having, where people can kind of get bent out of shape as if Satan was being paid the ransom. And we can create some clarity here. This is where things are getting a little bit nerdy, but this matters. And just stick with us for a little bit. I think that the way in which Paul is describing it is that we're being held captive in a domain because our sin, which we're held guilty of, is what put us in that domain. But when that sin is paid for, there's nothing that can hold us. And so there, I think there's a dual nature where the wrath of God must be appeased. That's being paid. And then the guilt and shame of our sin must also be cleansed. That's the record of debt in Colossians that he's talking about. And then in order to live in the kingdom, to get out of this kingdom that we're in, to live in the new kingdom, you have to have righteousness. That's the imputation. That's the substitutionary atonement nature of our gospel. But if you're going to ignore the concept of a ransom, all these passages, because then I get it, Doug. People are like, God doesn't know anything to anybody. Who could control anybody but God? Well, he's the one who set this up, and he's the one who wrote these things in his perfect word. So somehow we were underneath the domain of Satan. And I would argue that the divine counsel provides a pretty good explanation for that.
I was just thinking Psalm 82. So the divine counsel worldview explains how we are not only under the domain of sin, and how we're not only slaves to sin and slaves to death, but also we're slaves to Satan.
Right.
And how is that? Well, it's because of our sin at Tower of Babel. God gave humanity over to the heavenly beings, and it was a legal covenantal transaction, John.
Yeah.
And so that's why he has the authority to be the ruler of the world. He can give Jesus all things in this world because he was given that authority by God. But I think Psalm 82 comes in, and as the great disinheritance of these heavenly beings, they're disinherited from having that authority over the people because of their own sin. So their own sin was their breaking of the covenant that they had with God. And then I think that the when that becomes enacted is at the cross. Mm-hmm. So that becomes the time when they were judged and they were disinherited from owning the nations. And then all the other aspects that you brought up with sin and the substitutionary atonement,
well,
and those
put
kinds
to
of
open
things.
Open shame makes sense, right?
Yeah, exactly. So something, the point is that something happened in the spiritual, supernatural realm of the domain of Satan, especially in that realm of Hades, that has to do with Jesus's death. And the ransom theory, I think, is trying to get out what that is.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are so many aspects that are happening, right? So he's taking on the Father's wrath. He's paying for our sins. He's completing all righteousness, right? He completes righteousness on the cross. He lived the perfect life unto death and then conquers death at resurrection. And then, so that has ramifications for, I think, salvation of humanity and the restoration of creation. It's not just kind of one thing. Like, there's a lot going on. So we know there's a lot in the Reform world. There's a lot that's been written about substitutionary atonement. So let's talk a little bit more about how this idea of ransom, it's not just like, you were delivered out of the domain of darkness. Like the Bible has a lot to say, and it's fascinating when you start realizing this simple phrase, he disarmed the rulers. Well, when you disarm them, that means they're armed with something, right? They have power, they have control. So he disarmed the rulers and authority and put them to open shame by triumphing over them. Well, how did the triumph happen? Well, this goes back to what did they have? Well, we know that all of a sudden Jesus says in Revelation that he comes out with the keys of death and Hades. So first of all, he goes down there and says, you don't have the power to hold these gates shut anymore.
Right.
I hold the keys. And I don't think as a metaphor. I think this is what happened.
Yeah, like there's actually a place called Hades.
That's right.
And however the keys work, Jesus got them.
That's right. And they're capitalized, which is interesting, in the ESV. They capitalize death and Hades.
In Revelation 1, yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Which would seem to imply that it's either an entity or a personal name of a place, right?
Right. So here's the Trojan horse moment, okay? They put Jesus on the cross, and he dies. And they're like, great. We're done with the guy. And this is where Paul steps in and says, if they would have known, they would have never wheeled that horse into the gates. But they did it anyways. And what's the next thing that we learn? This is Ephesians chapter 4 from Paul. It says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives and gave gifts to men. Well, Paul's like, well, where was he ascending from? This is so great. That's verse 8, yeah. Verse 9.
Yeah.
In saying he ascended, by the way, and I love how Paul like speaks in reverse. He always like says the statement, then he comes back and clarifies it. Not should we sin that grace may abound? I mean, he does this all the time, right? So verse 9, in saying he ascended, what does it mean? But that he also descended into the lower regions of the earth. So first of all, we know that when Christ died, he descended not into the grave. It said the lower regions of the earth. So this is where it's described as the bosom of Abraham. This is paradise. This is where those who do not have the righteousness of Christ yet, they're waiting. And so it says when Christ died, he went down there and gathered them up. That's one thing that he did. The second thing that we know he did, according to 1 Peter, is that he went down there and proclaimed what? So this is 1 Peter 3:19. He went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison victory that he had won. And Peter straight up says, these are the spirits from the days of Noah. And we would argue that, I think pretty clear in the text, both from Jude and Peter, that these were the spirits, these angels who copulated with women and tried to stop the Messiah from coming. And so Jesus is like, hey, real quick, before we ascend, I need to go talk to some people. It's so good. He goes down, and this is part of putting him to open shame. Like, you tried to stop me, and you failed, and you need to know that you failed. And I want the whole world to know that you failed. And then the third verse, which you already mentioned, which is Revelation 1:18, it says, I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. So did you notice how it's written there? He died, and he lived, which means, what did he bring back with him? He brought back with him the keys. And Doug, I'm kind of jumping ahead here, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but who does he end up giving the keys to?
Who does Jesus give the keys to?
Sure.
His Father?
Well, doesn't he give the keys to the church?
Well, So you're thinking Matthew 16. Yeah.
That's right.
Exactly.
So he hands him the keys. He goes, storm the gates, gentlemen. Storm the gates.
Yeah. You know, that passage in Ephesians 4, the lower regions of the earth, sometimes that's translated the lower regions, the earth, as if Jesus is simply descending to earth. And it's talking about his descent as in the incarnation.
Right.
In fact, that's Michael Heiser's view, which for the life of me, I don't understand. I've never understood that.
It's interesting.
The whole context of this comes from Psalm 68, which in the two verses right before that's quoted, O mountain of God, mountain of Bashan, O many peak mountain of Bashan, why do you look at hatred, O many peak mountain, at the mountain that God desired for his abode, where the Lord will dwell forever? The chariots of God are twice 10,000, thousands upon thousands. The Lord is among them. Sinai is in the sanctuary. You ascended on high, leading a host of captives in your train. So why does that matter? Well, because Bashan is Mount Hermon. And Mount Hermon has at its base the gate of hell at Pan's cave in Pan's grotto. So it's a perfect visual representation of where Jesus went. And like you said, when you add these other passages to it, it's very clear that he descended into hell. The Apostles' Creed talks about how he descended into hell at a very specific time between his death and his resurrection. It doesn't say that he descended into hell and died and was raised. No, it says he died, then descended into hell and was raised. Why? Because that's the descent to hell is a real thing, which we've talked about in other episodes. But
sure,
just to bring that point home, this is exactly what Ephesians 4 is talking about. It's exactly what Psalm 68 is talking about. It's exactly what Psalm 24, who's at the gates, the King of Glory,
the King of Glory,
you know, let so me good. In because I'm here to storm your gates. This thing is actually found in many places in the Bible.
Yeah. Well, I think when you read the Bible from this way, even Romans changes for you. It says, for the wages of sin is death. Okay, so when Christ dies on the cross, he pays for the wage, right? And it's like, but what does Hebrews say? He who has the power over death, remember this? What is this? First Hebrews, what's talking, oh man, you know what I'm talking about, right? The verse, the one who has the power over death, that is Satan. Oh, it's killing me. Power over, I'll pull it up here in just a second.
Yeah, Hebrews 2:14. Since therefore the children share in the flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil.
Okay, tell me that's not connected to Romans, where it says for the wages of sin is death, and where it says that he conquered over, going back to Colossians, he defeated them, conquering them. Conquering them what? If Satan is the one, Hebrews 2:14, has the power over death, that means he took that power away from him. And Jesus says that somehow the way in which whoever who controls the keys has the power over it. So that he can't hold us in death anymore. I mean, this is all really beautiful language that is all given to us to help us understand that there's what you can see on the cross, and then there's what you can't see. And they're piecing all of this kind of like Vantage Point, that movie. They're piecing all these different stories and all these different narratives. And Peter and John and Paul and Jesus himself are piecing it all together. And when you look at it like this diamond you're talking about, what you see on the earthly level is the disciples flake, the Romans get angry, the Jews get him crucified. Somehow Lucifer is involved with Judas in there somehow, like it gets him to betray.
And Satan too, as he seeks to sift him.
Exactly. And then he dies and raises again. And that's kind of, it's like that part of the narrative, like that's all we really allow there to be. And yet you have all these passages and people say, well, they're just kind of weird. I'm like, no, this is the whole thing. When Paul says he disarmed them, you don't think they were disarmed because you don't really think there were power. And Paul's like, no, that's real power. There was real control here. And again, people are like, you guys are giving too much power and too much, you know, you're attributing too much to the kingdom of darkness. And that's where I'm like, man, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure we're giving it its appropriateness. That's what makes the gospel so beautiful, because of all of these things that Peter and Paul are telling us.
You know, it might be, we could do a whole episode on it, but I don't know that we need to. You brought up the sermon that I preached last week, and I think this actually fits exactly perfectly right here. This is in Acts 23, and you know, spend 5 minutes talking about it because it's so wild, and it's exactly what you're talking about with Satan with regard to the events of the crucifixion. Mm-hmm. But this is in the trial of Paul, when he stands before the Jewish Sanhedrin, which is the 70. That's not an incident. Coincidence. And in fact, Luke calls them the council, which I think he uses that language very deliberately. And so Paul's taken before the council, and then he stands up and he goes, I'm a Pharisee and a son of Pharisees. It's with respect to the hope of the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial. And then all of a sudden, Luke says that a big fight breaks out between the Pharisees and Sadducees because, then this is what it says, the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And it's like, what? Why are you even bringing that up? You know, right. He just mentioned the resurrection. Why are you adding angel and spirit? So it's interesting that angel is singular, and mm-hmm. so is spirit, and it's possible that Luke has in mind something like the angel of the Lord and the Holy Spirit. But it's also possible that in bringing up angel, that he's talking about not necessarily how the Sadducees denied that there are angels. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a tough one to swallow because they believe in the Torah. Mm-hmm. And there are angels all over the Torah. So how could they actually say that they believe in it with a straight face and then turn around and say, there's no such thing as angels? So some scholars have argued that what's going on here is not that they deny angels, but they deny specific functions of angels. Some of those functions might include the ability to prophesy, which Paul has literally just done when he put a curse on Ananias, the high priest, who ends up dying. So Paul becomes a prophet who carries out a covenant lawsuit on the high priest. But it's also, some have argued, that angel there could refer to the angels as the rulers of the nations. Now, why would that matter? Okay, so if you fast forward through the story, you find that the Jews make a plot, and listen to the language, John, and they bound themselves together by an oath, neither to eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. As soon as I read that, I was like, well, that sounds familiar, because that's exactly, and in fact, I only know one other story in all of ancient Jewish literature that tells this. It's the story of the watchers or the angels in 1 Enoch 6. That's how the story is told, that they will come down and be with the women, is they bind themselves together with an oath and swear that they will do this deed no matter what the consequences are. Then it gets even weirder because it says there were 40 of them. Okay, fine. But what does the number 40 remind you of? The flood?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the first place it's remind us of. And then as the story then plays out, you find that Paul has a nephew. Like, where'd this guy even come from? And he informs Paul that there's a plot to kill him. So Paul says, go and tell the Roman tribune about it. So he does. And the tribune actually listens to him. And then he says, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to get Paul out of town immediately. He tells a couple of soldiers this. And he says, I want you to go get 200 soldiers and 70 chariots and then 200 more spearmen. And get him out of Dodge. This happens at night, and they take him to Caesarea. Okay, like that seems, I don't know, a little bit of overkill for one dude, 470 people. And most people just focus on that. But what they don't focus on is the numbers. Because the number 200, exactly what Luke says, that's how many watchers swore the oath, bro, in Enoch, 200. And the number 70 is the number of the divine council and the Sanhedrin. And the number 40 is the number of the flood. And if you had to pick three and only three numbers that told that story, those would be the three numbers. And the whole thing happens at night. And what's so interesting to me is that after the watchers do this in Enoch, the angels bind the fallen watchers in Dudael, this place of darkness, place at night. And then right after that, Enoch ascends to these seven hills, and it becomes a kind of a paradise, a retreat for him, a place of safety, which is exactly what Caesarea becomes for Paul, totally ironically, because it's not Jerusalem that's the place that you would think. This is Jerusalem, the holy city, the place that should be where Paul is safe. No, it's Caesarea, a city named after a stinking Caesar, a Roman Caesar. And so this is a more subversion, I believe, sure. Where what, and here's how it connects to what we were just talking about. The subversion is that you Jews in this trial with Paul are acting exactly like the satanic watchers in the story of Enoch that you say don't even exist. That's the connection. It's the Satan connection. They are acting satanically, and Luke is saying this is a satanically inspired act to try and get Paul killed. And in saving Paul, because Paul doesn't die and rise from the dead in a resurrection, but it becomes a symbolic resurrection so that Paul can now continue his mission of spreading the gospel, just like what happens after Jesus is raised from the dead and then commissions his church to go and spread the gospel. The whole thing is a mirror of Jesus' passion and resurrection, and therefore the satanic plot fits right into what we're talking about.
It's like if you're going to try and use a subliminal message telling somebody they're a terrorist, you're like, yeah, call 911. I think you can order a plane ticket there. If not, there's a building.
I know exactly. It's like if I said something like, ask not what your church can do but for you, but what you can do for your church, whatever. Yeah. You would know that I'm riffing off RFK's country speech, right?
Totally.
And that's exactly what Luke is doing. He's riffing off the Enoch story in order to make this totally subliminal point that you people are satanic.
Well, and it's fascinating how much the Bible does this. And this is kind of the whole point. This is why I think that the whole putting them to open shame, it's that by their own hand, they crucified Jesus and brought their own shame. That's what makes it so fascinating, right? It's like they don't even understand what they're doing. And later on, Paul's like, and if they did understand what they were doing, they would have never done it.
Exactly.
Right. And that's what I think, you know, it's... what I think is fascinating, and again, you know, can't even remember if I put this out in my sermon. I don't think I did. I think I did. So the very first creature to hear about the plan of what's going to happen after the fall of humanity is Satan. He's told first, your head will be crushed by the seed of Eve. And I started thinking about this through, like, you know, what does Eve say? I have gotten a man from the help of the Lord. Like, this is it. And Satan's like, great. Now I'm going to convince him to murder his brother. You know, it's fascinating when you start thinking about the story. So
did you know that when it says sin is crouching at your door, that line there?
Yeah.
When God comes to Cain, sin is crouching at your door. Did you know that the word Rabahat, I think it's Rabahat's there. That's the word for a demon.
No way.
Yeah, it's a Middle Eastern demon. So there you go.
There you go. I mean, and what is Satan? What does Peter call Satan? A roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. There you go. I took that out of my sermon. I had a whole thing about like all the times that Satan attempted to take out Jesus. But that being said, I don't think it's ironic how Jesus died. Sure, he died by Roman hand, but there's all these little subtle things that like he's going to crush the head of the serpent. And what ends up happening to Jesus? He ends up being crushed, right? And so there's like, yeah, you're going to crush me. Watch this. And he like, in his mind, he thinks the destruction. And there is, I mean, everybody around is mourning. All the disciples are mourning. Like, what happened? Like, this is, we did not see this coming. And that's the subliminal message of like, when he raises from the grave, it's like literally all hell breaks loose. It's like the whole thing just disrupted the whole plan. And I think it's beautiful. I think Paul's summary of it is glorious. And it helps you step back and go, and it's not done, because it's not like he stormed the gates of hell and all of a sudden everything is over now. Like, well, you could just relax, because it's like if Paul wanted us relaxed, he should have never wrote Ephesians, and Peter should have never wrote Peter. Because then
Jesus should have never given the keys to Peter.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. All right, so now I want to talk about that for a moment. Because what's fascinating is Jesus rises from the grave, then turns to the disciples and says, all authority in heaven and on earth, right? Wherever there may have been opposition before, or wherever I didn't have authority because the nations hadn't been given to me yet.
Right.
I now have inherited the nations. I have authority in all lands. And the thing that's locking them up that we couldn't get into, which was death, I have the keys. So it literally says the gates of hell will not prevail, because they can't, because I have the keys.
That's the under the earth. And that's right. That reminds me of Philippians, where every knee will bow to Jesus in heaven and on earth and under the earth.
That's right. That's that. I hadn't even thought about that. That's actually a really good point. So what is the church doing now? The church, Jesus rolled, I mean, this is the image. Jesus rolled the cross into the city, and then he goes, all right, guys, let's go. Because they can't stop us. We hold the keys. And what do? Gates are not, they're not offensive. They're defensive. They're mean to keep things in or out.
Well, usually, I suppose they could keep you from leaving if you were locked in. But
there you go.
Usually that's not the case.
Right. But that's kind of how it's, I mean, it is a both end in this situation. We're coming in to take people out.
There were captives in hell that could not be released until they freed.
That's right. And that's why Jesus went and took the, not that they were in, they're in paradise, Hades.
Yeah. Like right.
Paradise.
Yeah. Again, for folks that haven't heard those older shows that we've done on Hades, Hades is a country. Think of it like a country, a big land, and it has different parts to it, just like any country does. Mm-hmm. And the paradise part, the Elysium part, the Abraham's bosom part, is where the righteous dead went. Mm-hmm. And then those are the ones who are released when Jesus goes down, because he had then paid for their sin on the cross, thereby freeing them of that legal hold that their sin had upon them that kept them down there in the first place.
That's right. Two recommendations. First, our episode on the descent of Christ. And then Sam Renahan's book, Crooks, Moors, and Ferney, or The Descent of Christ. You can look at either of those on Amazon. Recommend that. But what I encourage us is that the way in which it's described, even Revelation talks about this in chapter 12, where the great accuser is sent down to the earth, and now he's wreaking more havoc now than ever. It's because the strong man has been bound, and we went in and plundered the house, as Jesus is talking about. And now there's havoc because the church's mission, like stage one, was fulfilled. Messiah came, broke the bonds of sin, got the keys, opened up the gates, and it's like, okay, phase two is now here, and now we're storming the gates of hell. Though in the way in which we do that is we're proclaiming the gospel around the world. And
by the power of the word, would you say? Could that be a little foreshadowing for next episode?
Maybe. How can they believe unless they hear? Faith comes by hearing the word of the Lord. We'll talk about that next week. But what I think is interesting is that, and this is why Doug and I want to do this podcast, because we think the church needs to be equipped to think this way. Satan does not, Satan's good with you being a good moral person. He's good. He's even good with you being very Christianese in nature, but he needs you to stop doing things that have power. And that's called preaching the gospel. Jug, how many churches today just don't preach the gospel? They just don't. Well, Satan's like, fine, as long as you don't preach the gospel, we're good to go, because the gospel is what brings this whole kingdom to an end. Satan's kingdom is coming to an end, and the only way that it's ended is by the proclamation of the gospel by the church. So now going forward, we storm the gates of hell, not with morality, not with law. Morality and law is necessary in the function of the kingdom. We need the law to expose sin. We need morality to protect us from our sinful ways, because sin blinds us. But the only power that stops Satan and advances the kingdom is the gospel. That's why this conversation is so important. And I love the idea when you realize that every conversation you have, every interaction that you have, you're standing at the gate of hell. You literally are standing at the gate of hell because someone is on the other side. And if they're still in death because of the wages of their sin, the way which we call them out is by the beauty and the light of the gospel, right? And so this is why it's important not to get in fight and be ugly and nasty to people, because you don't know where they're at. You know, this is why Paul's like, be kind to all, be gentle, be ready to give an answer of the hope that lies within you. So I get excited. I had a pastor friend of mine that says, he told me, he's like, I love living in a world where this is real, because it makes so much more sense to me, Doug, than there's so much pain, so much confusion, so much just filth. I mean, just, by the way, Satan's also good with, you know, destroying people. He's good with, you know, there being no gospel. He also likes just murdering 100 million babies and having
I think that's
commit it's suicide like too.
The catch is that it starts off and it promises you all these great rewards and the happiness and the health and the wealth and all these good things, but it never ends that way. It always ends in what you're talking about.
Oh, well, that kind of leads us into next week. How do words matter? And what's the difference between, you know, when we talk about the power of words and like the prosperity gospel, the health and wealth gospel? It's a good question. I'll have to tune in next week. So hopefully this is encouraging to you. Go back and you can, I have an article on my website, or it's in the Fringe. You go there and find it on how the Trojan, or how the cross is the Trojan horse of hell. And then my sermon, will link it in here. And maybe you'll be encouraged and help join the reformation of us putting the Fringe back in the Reformed.
You know, somebody put, speaking of the Reformed Fringe, somebody put this song, The Victor by Keith Green, up just this week. And it was so good. Hadn't heard the song in a long time, but I'll just read two stanzas of it because it's exactly what we're talking about. This is the kind of stuff you get on the Fringe. People just put it up, just put this stuff up. Just look, the gates of hell, they're falling, crumbling from the inside out. He's bursting through the walls with laughter. Ha, listen to the angels shout. And then just listen to those demons screaming. See him bruise the serpent's head. The prisoners of hell, he's redeeming. Oh, all the power of death is dead. Go listen to your Keith Green. A lot of younger Christians probably have never even heard of him. He was actually CCM when CCM was good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's like an old hymn right there, man. That's some good stuff. So, well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys. If you want to support what we're doing, share us on social media. We have social media accounts. Go to YouTube and subscribe and make a comment, like there. It's free, but it also helps us get more people the light of the gospel. So just a simple way for you guys to participate in what we're doing. We'll talk to you next week.